Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning, welcome morning to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio.
Yes.
This show is all about science in all its different forms, so we talk about all sorts of things and we also play some rather cool music. Later in this hour, we'll be speaking to RPG and we've also got our guest speaker for this week and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month. It's Chris Dale and he's going to be talking about a programme in Doncaster which encourages healthy eating for babies, continuing the theme of how important it is what you eat and the perils of ultra-processed food, which are everywhere. Lots to talk about. Where shall we start? All being well as well next week, because there's 5 Saturdays in the month, I believe. We might get our full Muffet on.
Yes.
See what we can get him to talk about. This next article I saw in the RHS magazine, Royal Horticultural Society, they're doing quite a lot science-based now, which I think is brilliant. The article's titled, "The Study Shows Nature Boosts Well-being." Good old bit of vitamin G, as they say. Actively noticing things such as birdsong, plant textures and scents can improve well-being significantly. According to research conducted at the Royal Horticultural Society Garden Wisley, the study was led by the University of Surrey in collaboration with the University of Sheffield. Hurrah, eh? And yes, also Royal Horticultural Society scientists. They asked 79 participants to respond to natural or man-made elements in the garden. The group listening to birdsong, touching plants and admiring the view reported better well-being levels than those asked to notice buildings, paths and man-made sounds such as traffic noise and the control group that received no prompts. It shows what we pay attention to matters. And that so says Professor Alistair Griffiths, who's the RHS Director of Science. He says, engaging with natural elements can unlock deeper restorative benefits, which has powerful implications for how we design and manage public green spaces. We've often talked on the Life Science Radio Show about the importance of green spaces and your well-being, and we do sometimes call it vitamin G or vitamin green. Participants focusing on nature felt calmer, more connected to their surroundings, with slowed breathing and reduced stress. The findings of that research will feed into a new Royal Horticultural Society blueprint for well-being gardens, due to launch in 2026. Using scientific research and real-life examples, it will help people make gardens to support well-being at home, in the community, or for organisations. Which I find it really interesting, because the RHS is trying to get people, much more wider, diverse range of people involved in the garden. And they've spent a lot of time in recent years developing areas of the gardens, the show gardens and things, that actually you can eat. Growing your own food, going back to all that. Great stuff, eh? Next up, elsewhere in the science news. Ooh, climate of the party is 30, Paul. Tell us.
Yeah, COP 30, COP30, is currently taking place in Brazil in November, between the 10th and the 21st of November.
Actually, then it's just finished.
Yes.
Blimey.
Yes, yeah. COP 30 stands for the 30th meeting of the Conference of the Parties, COP, to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, which was a landmark international treaty agreed in 1992 and parent treaty to the 2015 Paris Agreement. COP 30 brings world leaders and other key parties together to agree on the actions needed to address the climate crisis, such as limiting the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Last year was the hottest ever record, and 60 leading climate scientists said in June that Earth could breach that 1.5 rise in as little 3 years at current levels of carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest about COP 30. Some of the big players, China, Russia, America, weren't there. People are questioning what the use of it is. But if you look elsewhere in the news and you see things like this next article, last year was also one of the most devastating fire seasons in that Amazon's history. Once confined from July to October, the fire season is now lengthening and intensifying each year, and that's all to do with climate change.
And back to home, closer to home, our seasons are also in a disarray as a result of climate change. Row upon row of poppies are currently blooming in the fields on the Holcombe Estate in Norfolk. A beautiful sight, but of course, very unusual for this time of year. RHS Wisley in Surrey and RHS Rosemore in North Devon also have dahlias, salvias, late blooming daisies and red hot pokers still in flower. Is this the new normal?
Well, this morning I found a ladybird in our garden.
It's and been frozen.
It's still alive. I can't believe it. It's absolutely bizarre. On a happier note, there have been more solar panels installed on Britain's rooftops this year than ever before. The number of installations, 203,125 to be precise, surpassed a record set in 2011, when actually at that time the government was offering very generous subsidies for the technology. Installation costs for solar panels are actually higher now. So that increase in installation is basically showing that solar energy is no longer dependent upon government subsidy. Solar panels are booming because they are cost effective in the long run.
But aren't they very hard to recycle?
Well, they probably are, but
maybe the old technology.
The next article goes on to see what you can do if you engage with that technology fully.
Right, indeed, the bigger impact of the solar energy boom is already to be found in China, where carbon emissions have now been flatlining for 18 months, according to new analysis by the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. China, whom is the world's biggest carbon emitter, is cleaning up its act and cutting its emissions by installing more solar panels this year than the United States has ever deployed.
Very interesting. Meanwhile, a research centre led by a team at the University of Nottingham has provided a beacon of hope for patients diagnosed with glioblastoma, which is the most common and deadliest type of brain tumour, affecting 3,200 people in the UK each year. Outcomes are dire, with an average life expectancy of 1 year after diagnosis. Research has traditionally been poorly funded, meaning treatment has not changed for two decades. The £2.6 million Centre of Excellence, which has been funded by the charity Brain Tumour Research, is running a world-first study involving 50 patients. It will provide personalised treatment, tailoring drugs to the specific genetic mutations of a patient's brain cancer to stop it growing back.
Elsewhere in the news, monarch butterflies are one of nature's wonders as they migrate all the way from Canada to Mexico, clustering together in the treetops in chandelier-like masses and then flying north again. Scientists have now worked out how to track individual monarch butterflies for the first time with the help of tiny sensors on their wings. They must be absolutely minute. In the hope that they can work out what could help save these creatures from decline.
And finally, beavers may make for unruly neighbours, beginning building work as soon as they move in. But research by the University of Stirling has revealed that other species welcome their arrival. Surveying beaver ponds in Banff Wildland, a rewilded estate in Perthshire, the researchers found that they hosted 45% more butterflies and 119% more hoverflies than man-made ponds, offering hope that the return of beavers to Britain's waterways may be great news for these declining pollinators. Song that is a Bridge Over Troubled Water, yes, by Simon and Garfunkel from, can you believe, 1970. We played that because we're talking about the return of beavers for Britain's waterways, maybe great news for declining pollinators such as butterflies and hoverflies. All good news there. You are listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, which is our PG on the line. Morning, PG.
Morning. Good morning.
A rather drizzly, miserable morning.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's been a noisy morning as well, which I'll come round to in a bit.
Oh, I say. I hope that's not your cat refusing to go out.
No, no.
Oh, I say. So what's caught your eye in the news, science news this week then, Paul?
Well, I think we saw the Rob Burrows Centre opening with Prince William. And Rob Burrows has made such an impact, making people aware of MND, and the local sort of response has been to help out with things, and also from Rob Burrows Foundation, something coming the other way. So Sheffield University have appointed the first MND Association Rob Burrow Professor.
Oh, wow.
So it's a Sheffield neurologist, and it's really the first appointment, or one of the first appointments, I think. So he's a world-leading neurologist and geneticist from the University of Sheffield, has been appointed to be the first Rob Burrow Professorship in Translational Neurobiology, named after the late rugby legend Rob Burrows. This is Dr. Jonathan Cooper-Knock, and he's a world-leading, as I say, neurologist and geneticist, and he's at the University of Sheffield's Institute for Translational Neuroscience, and has been appointed as the first Rob Burrow Professorship, and the funding has gone along with the honour to help Dr. Cooper-Knock accelerate his research in hunting for the genes that are underpinning motor neurone disease and open up new pathways towards promising treatments.
Wow.
So a great link up there with something that I think touched everybody's heart. I think the story of Rob Burrow.
Yeah, yeah. And good old Sheffield University. They're very much up there, aren't they, all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even though Rob's gone, his wife carries on. She did a three-legged race, I think, in support of Pudsey there, and getting to some charity with Amy from the local news programme. But also at the university, they've been doing some work on new drug candidates for slowing down MND progress. So practical results show that the new medicine, which switches off cell defences, could significantly slow the progression of the disease. So, again, research is from the University of Sheffield's Institute for Translational Neuroscience have been studying things, and in studies of MND mouse models, M102 proved improved movement, gait and motor neuron health. And in cell models derived from MND patients, motor neuron protection was also achieved. So again, at the forefront of work to try and help people with MND. So I think that's a pretty good contribution from a local university.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I think the other thing that sort of struck me today was my dawn call from the traffic going past. Because we've got a sunken grate, and we're also on the main sort of route from the south into the city, I think, nowadays. So all the heavy goods vehicles and things come clattering past. So it's really quite annoying in the morning. And last night was very quiet because the trams were not running because they had a problem with the overhead electrical cables, apparently. Still not completely sorted out. May take a few days. So there are changes to the tram routes, if anybody's interested. They can find out. I think the purple route from this side of town is running okay, but the blue and yellow routes have got some things affected, so you need to look out. I think from this side of town, it's pushing them out to 20 minutes. I think time between trams, but sort of thinking on, and I'm thinking, well, if we want to go back to the early 60s, the Beatles sang about 10,000 holes in Blackman, Lancashire.
They did.
Which was a reference to potholes, so that's probably... 60 years ago, we were moaning about potholes. And what are we doing now pretty much every season when the weather changes? So a quick search online gets you some artificial intelligence support and a quick sort of summary of the facts around why our roads are so poor, and it is saying that basically we've suffered from a long-term low investment in infrastructure. So councils have repeatedly taken the lowest, cheapest quote for doing their work to create roads and maintain roads, and we pay the price. And the other sort of overriding thing seems to be our weather. So we've had quite an unusual amount of rain, so hopefully filling up the reservoirs. But the story is that our season is just not one freeze and spring, but we can have actually 40 or 50 freeze and thaw activities. And each time the road surface is frozen and thawed, it creates some damage. And eventually that damage is exacerbated by the size of heavy goods vehicles, which I can vouch for. Quite often, the trams, I think, depending on which model it is, are 30 tonnes or 40 tonnes for the tram train versions. And we've got heavy goods vehicles that are approaching those weights as well. So if you imagine a section of road that's very busy, it's supporting an awful lot of weight. And a lot of the time that will be spread over a large number of wheels. But as this morning, I get a gentle shaking of the house as these heavy goods things go past, and the trams, and the road surfaces don't improve. So looking again, I thought, well, whenever I talk to people, one of the things that comes up about the roads is, you know, in Sheffield, if you go on some of the side roads and have a look at any sort of damage to the surface, there's a thin layer of tarmac over the top of the old cobbles. So I thought, well, yeah, and if you want to go to the old Roman roads, we can still find evidence of the Roman road construction, you know, 1,000 years after.
Yeah, I know.
It was built.
We know where you're going, Paul.
Yeah, so it's just kind of, yes, okay, we've got a massive increase in traffic and all the rest of it, but our construction methods don't seem to have changed for a long time. So again, looking at material science, looking at things, and there is some research going on for improving pavements, and a lot of the time the benefit from cobbles was said to be that they were more readily draining water away and could provide extra grip as opposed to a very smooth tarmac surface, which if you drive and you've experienced a thing called aquaplaning, it's a patch of water that's settled on motorways and things, and all of a sudden you don't have an awful lot of control over your steering.
No.
So it's one of those things, again, it seems that over 1,000 years we could have come up with some better solutions, but they don't appear to be coming, and one of the big drivers for that is cost. So how do we improve the roads? I think, unfortunately, like many things, it's something that needs investment, and a bit like our opening thing, it needs some funding for research into materials and applications, because it seems, again, one of the strange things that I find with chatting to people about large projects in the UK is, on one side of the people think that we're very good at large projects, especially I think people who are involved with construction and associated areas. But on the other side, it's, why do we have disasters like HS2? what really is going wrong? And I think that's an underlying question again that needs to have some answers provided for. So it's really sort of quite difficult, but they're sort of local homegrown things. The other couple of things that I've found in the news has been signs of sort of ripples in the smooth pond of artificial intelligence development. So we've had a couple of executives from Meta who sort of said, be wary that we get into the point where the bubble bursts in terms of the amount of investment that's been ploughed into artificial intelligence and developing it. Another one which has said, actually, it's the long language version of artificial intelligence, the way it learns, that maybe is questionable now and wants to see a machine-learned route, which will change things slightly differently. So artificial intelligence has been riding the crest of a wave for a while. Lots of things are invested. As I say, now, quite regularly on my computer, I'll get the artificial intelligence suggestion pops up as the lead item.
Yeah, and it's not always right, I'm afraid.
That's correct.
Sometimes it's absolutely way off the mark.
Yeah, and again, if you want to ask broad questions, then you tend to get broad answers, which is fine, but the detail is necessary for us to improve a lot of the things that we see day to day that have an impact on us, and we really have not getting those answers directly. So when you hear the voice, I mean, if you sit and listen to a session of Parliament on any of those kind of areas, it's a real sort of mishmash of opinion, and to actually filter out of that a positive course of action is very, very difficult. So I think science is very good at coming up with answers. It tends to do that by evaluating current state of play. So I think that the UK, unfortunately, we're really sort of led down a path with entrepreneurial engineering in the Victorian era, where they tried it, fixed it, and sort of went through the iterations to improve things. But a lot of that, if you actually look behind that, there was a funding model where, if you look at the canals, the problem used to be that they got to get money from industry and from local people to invest in build the canals, and we ended up with some substantial sort of engineering projects, things like the tunnels that they had to create, and also the ability to map the terrain. And you can see the results of that, where there are systems of a dozen locks to rise from level of the surface up to a higher level and maintain the water in the system that the canals use. With the roads, we saw in the 60s some kind of changes with concrete structures, so bridges, spans, a lot of those things came from the use of concrete. And then you see, if you want an example of that, the Tinsley Viaduct is constantly monitored by sensors to look into how healthy it is. Because when we started out in, again, the early 60s with the motorway networks, we didn't have a huge amount of traffic. And now we've gone through iterations which cause problems like, shall we use the hard shoulder to dissipate a bit more of the traffic across the surface available? and things like overhead gantries to change the speed limits. And you sort of are looking at those kind of things being part developments as you go along. And again, I think one of the sort of political footballs has been where investment's been gravitated towards London and the southeast. Then you look at other projects which have gone astray. So I think our railway networks have not substantially improved since we saw, again, back end of the 60s, Beeching's railway cuts to reduce the amount of traffic on the system. And we had a couple of attempts at high-speed trains with things like Pendolino, the train that leads into curves. And if you actually have a look, watch the recent thing on TV about the early railways, and the entrepreneurial approach ended up with a significant clash between narrow gauge and wide gauge railway in the UK, and the narrow gauge won out. So it's one of the things that you can actually see locally. If you study the tram train or the convertible tram that can run on railway tracks, it's got a system on the wheels to shrink and expand to accommodate the tracks that are gauges. So a lot of stuff that we sort of get into every day, and the question is, I think, what we've got a will to do. It's, I think we tried to take car the roads, and you can see Sheffield's made lots of attempts at creating cycleways, but the underlying thing, I think, is we're probably not fit enough overall to be able to cycle up and down the hills in Sheffield.
Well, we won't touch on the fact that one of the most astonishing things I've read about recently is the government wanting to charge electric vehicle drivers for the mileage they do. And, you know, in terms of transport policy, the whole point of electric vehicles and hybrids was to encourage people to drive cleaner,
yep,
to improve air quality, yep, albeit I always used to say, well, if everybody drives electric, yeah, we ain't got any pollution, but we're not going to go anywhere because we'll all be stuck in congestion, and that's exactly what's happening. But I just think, we'll save that for another day, Paul, to talk about the policy changes there, because I think people, this just does not make any sense at all. But obviously it's a tax issue, isn't it? No income from fuel.
I'll leave you with a quick update on robots.
Oh, good. Because we've got a great track for you, Paul.
Finally. Yeah.
Finally. Well,
we took it off cassette tape.
I think the dilemma in science fiction everything is where robots stop to become servants of man, to become sort of oppressors of mankind. And one of the things that was in the news was that the famous sort of dog-shaped robots that are being used in things like rescue operations and lots of other things. In China, they managed to mount a machine gun on the top of one of the robot dogs, and the theory is that it's going to be autonomous, so it can wander around with a heavily laden machine gun and make its own choices about who.
Oh, dear.
Can't wait.
So maybe great things that can be useful. You see them in industry and everywhere, but equally, man can always have an ingenuity to misuse things.
Indeed. And on that note, we actually watched the original Star Wars the other night, A New Hope Episode 4, but actually it was the first ever one, 1977, and we just loved R2-D2 and C-3PO. You know, yeah, and we're just like, they're the real robots.
Yeah, well, that's it. I think, be careful the robots you choose.
Exactly. And on that note, Paul, brilliant. And we'll speak to you Monday on Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye-bye.
Great.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye. Bye.
The Robots by Kraftwerk. What a cracking tune, eh? We played that because RPG was talking about all sorts of, including robots and AI. You are listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have had Chris on the line. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, team.
Good morning. We're very well, morning. Chris. Thank you for joining us. We've just brought you in on a cracking bit of Guns N' Roses there.
Yeah, I was listening to Soul Plus earlier.
Oh, were you?
I noticed that you played Courtney Pine. Just to say, I went and saw Courtney Pine live a few years ago, and all I have to say is you've got to like clarinets.
Oh, he was amazing. We saw him when he came to the Lead Mill way back, and Bob Kerslake was at the same gig. Can you believe?
Bob Kerslake. What a man he was.
Well, a very interesting man. Sadly died very young, didn't he? I think in his 60s. But so good. You enjoyed Soul Plus, did you? Excellent.
Good.
Excellent stuff.
Did you like the Clash? Did you like the Clash? It's a bit of a strange track, that one. Yeah. Oh, but yeah, you're not here to talk about that, Chris. Chris Dale's here to talk, as usual, about diets, ultra-processed foods, and in particular, you've got a local story.
Yeah, well, this is about a program that teaches parents how to feed babies nutritious food and is helping to change family diets and improve health in Doncaster, which is what, you know, is right down our street.
It's a local thing, and it's something that's affecting the whole country, not just Doncaster.
It's affecting the whole of Western Europe.
Well, it is, exactly.
So just to give some context to it, in September we spoke about baby food manufacturers who must cut levels of salt and sugar in their products and stop promoting snacks for babies under the age of one. New government guidance would also restrict the use of marketing claims that suggest health benefits without any scientific evidence, and firms that do not make their products healthier within 18 months may face legal action. And all this came after a BBC investigation found that top brand baby food pouches lacked key nutrients, and parents were often being misled by marketing. And on the back of this, the NHS advice was updated to tell parents they should not rely on baby food pouches as everyday meals, with experts believing they can cause health problems for children if they are used as their main source of nutrition. So we have a good news story here, because in Doncaster, there's a community-based Nourish and Nurture initiative, and they work with new parents in Doncaster and aims to tackle obesity by encouraging healthy eating habits. Now, the City of Doncaster has funded the sessions, which are run by dietitians and provide advice and skills on feeding routines in the child's first year. And Hayley Crummett, that's her name, isn't it? Hayley Crummett is a midwife on the programme, and she said the statistics show that if we can work on nutrition from early doors, we can really improve long-term health outcomes for children as they grow into adulthood. Well, Julie and Paul, how long have we been talking about this now?
Well, a good few years, Chris. But, you know, one of the shocking things was you were saying that there's more than 70% of adults in Doncaster are overweight or obese, which is
it has one of the highest rates. But in addition to that, in Yorkshire and Humber, the percentage of children aged 4 to 5 classed as living with obesity has increased from 9.8% in the academic year ending 2008 to 10.7% in 2024. So that's nearly a 1% rise, according to the NHS England's National Child Measurement Programme. So we actually do have quite high rates of obesity in Doncaster, and the national average is about 64%. And here in Doncaster, we're looking about 74%.
Wow, but it's staggering. I mean, 64% is a national. I'm sure if you look back 10, 20, 30 years, it would be nowhere near that level.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it is down to manufactured food and us just people just not eating healthily.
Yeah.
So getting back to this nurture and nature feeding program, the sessions are run daily across 12 family hubs in the City of Doncaster and are staffed by a team of dedicated dietitians and early years professionals. Gabriella Cheatham from Hickleton, which is the next village down from me, is one of the new mothers using the programme. Her six-month daughter, Aria, was struggling to best breastfeed, and the 31-year-old said, "The first session, it was to get to know us, and I had obviously come with a problem, an issue I wanted to talk about. They were really supportive, and it's good to have people that know what they're doing. They are qualified to talk to us about feeding, and they do it in a really friendly and supportive way." And again, we know how important it is, don't we, if mothers can breastfeed, is to do that, because it gives the baby the best start in life.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So this program is open to families expecting a baby or adopting a baby, and parents and carers of babies up to their first birthday. Now, why do we need this? Well, there's a case study that was shared as part of this report. It's very, very sad, but a baby recently died when its parents tried to wean it on Ready Breck. The parents, who were just 18 at the time, struggling financially, and they found that the recommended baby rice was just too expensive, so they switched their baby son to adult food, including Ready Breck. But unfortunately, the salt content could not be digested at such a young age, and the baby died of salt poisoning. I would just add, though, that Ready Breck is not marketed as a baby food.
There was nothing,
it wasn't anything that Ready Breck did, and that sort of gives you a context, not just about obesity and things like that, why the education around feeding of a baby is so important, because the parents thought they were doing the right thing, and unfortunately, obviously, they weren't. So in Doncaster, parents prepare fresh vegetables as part of the Nourish and Nurture sessions. And a new father to a baby was at the session, found it very helpful. He said, "I wasn't sure what I was coming into. We're just trying to get all the information we can before we start weaning our daughter in the next few weeks. And we got some information about allergens, which is one of our big concerns." And of course, we've touched on allergens as well. The Live Science radio show, and what a real impact they can have. And the more that I sort of think about it, the more that I just think what a superb idea this is, because it's covering sort of all the bases of the child's first year, and it really gives them a good start in life. So during the sessions, which last about 2 hours, parents are encouraged to take part in practical food preparation and exercises using healthy ingredients and following very simple recipes. It's been really nice, said a new patient. Rupert, my son, is now eating what's been cooked and it's going down a treat. And again, we spoke about that, didn't we, is that when you start giving children processed food at a very young age, they get that taste for the salt and the sugar,
which is exactly what
the government are trying to ban. And then they start to really struggle to eat proper healthy food because their palates can't take it because they're not used to that fresh taste. So it's fantastic to hear that this parent is saying that that he's cooking for his son and his son is eating it and it's going down a treat.
And I bet the parents are eating it as well. Which is...
Well, that's the other benefit, yes. Absolutely, 100%. That's the other benefit that parents who are attending these sessions are actually cooking more for themselves and not relying on takeaways, not relying on ready meals and not reliant on ultra-processed food. So that, again, is...
So they're pretty groundbreaking, are they then, Doncaster? I guess they're the first, are they, to be doing something like this?
I don't think that they are necessarily the first to be doing it, but it certainly is the first time that they are. I mean, there's been lots of sort of initiatives around trying to get healthy eating. I mean, we had obviously Jamie Oliver trying to improve school meals and things like that. But this one specifically targets that
first year.
The first year of babies.
What's really interesting, though, I thought, was when you talked about that young couple, you know, the cost of living and, you know, everything, that's a big issue, isn't it, for people?
It's
buying food and people often think that ready meals are somehow cheaper than making your own.
Yeah, and they aren't always, because quite often they're quite small portions. And of course, the ready meals have to have a long shelf life. So they're full of additives and preservatives and fats and sugar and salt. So they're not actually good for you. I mean, a ready meal very, very occasionally, I can understand, but it shouldn't be part of your mainstream diet at all. And I think we've used this statistic many times before, but if you make a lemon drizzle cake and you make it at home, it costs £4.50. To make it in a factory, it's 23 pence.
But it's full of chemicals, isn't it? No lemon has seen that lemon drizzle cake in a factory generally.
So just to conclude my little piece, it says the council hopes the project will reach hundreds of families over the next 3 years, building their confidence with feeding and creating lasting healthy routines.
Yeah, and that's the important thing. Yeah.
That is breaking people away from that sort of easy fix. But then, you know, we need to sort of take this healthy eating not just into the baby phase but also into the toddler phase and also into the infant phase, because some of the big sort of brands like Kellogg's and things like that, they are pushing like mad cereals with sugar in, and they say that they're fortified with vitamins and all this sort of stuff, but the bottom line is, even at that sort of toddler age and infant age, they're still trying to get that sort of people hooked upon that salt, sugar, fat taste, and to get used to buying products, because that's how they make their money.
Indeed.
And I think it's really bad.
It is.
I just wanted to say that I think on behalf of the Life Science Show, we just wanted to say well done, Doncaster, didn't we?
Well done, City of Doncaster. Yes. Indeed. Yeah. Great stuff, Chris. And it's a great story, and quite, you know, it's really sad about what happened to that baby, but it just shows, you know, people need to be aware of these things. And if you can get children and young babies to eat well to start with, they're on a great path, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I just thought this was perhaps a bit more of a good news story, because it was showing that people are actually doing something and it's working, and it's not just impacting on the babies, but it's impacting on the whole family
as
well.
On the parents. Yeah. Great stuff, Chris. Yeah. Thank you for joining
us.
Thank you. And we're going to play you out. Yes, bye-bye with a bit more of Guns N' Roses. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Sweet Child of Mine there by Guns N' Roses, of course, and we played that because we were talking to Chris Dale about a programme that teaches parents how to feed babies nutritious food and is helping to change families' diets and improve health in Doncaster. The programme's called Nourish and Nurture. All good stuff, eh? You're all listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. Sadly, there'll be no film show today, but all being well, they'll be back in next week. So we're going to finish off today with another story from the Royal Horticultural Society, another great article in their magazine. You can learn more at growfruittrees.co.uk. So what's it all about then? People making a difference. Donna Cooper, who's a director at Grow Fruit Trees, which is a nursery in Kent that grows and donates apple trees to UK schools. She says, "We plant hope every time we plant a tree. In 2024, over 1,000 trees were donated to more than 80 schools and community groups across the UK. Individuals and corporates keen to reduce their carbon footprint sponsor the trees, all of which are grown at our family-run nursery dedicated to conserving Britain's rare and heritage fruit tree selections from the National Fruit Collection at Brogdale." Who knew that? Not me. Food poverty in schools has become a growing concern since the COVID-19 pandemic, and several schools have requested apple trees so they can provide fresh produce to struggling families. And what started a decade ago with environmental and educational goals is now vital for addressing this social issue. And she says it's a rewarding challenge. While we only donate apple trees because they are well suited for children to care for, we respond to each school's priorities. At a school for children with additional needs, small dwarf trees were selected because they're easier for wheelchair users to reach. For pupils with impaired vision, cultivars such as Malus domestica or Knobby russets, with their distinctive lumps and bumps, and furry-skinned Egremont russets, help engage other senses. Other schools may request apples for juicing, cooking, or for suitability to the local soil and climate. And Donna Cooper says, supermarkets don't stock the specimens we grow. The UK actually imports 90% of its fruit and vegetables. So we're one of the few places on earth where certain cultivars of apples, pears and plums can still be found. She says their company, which is Grow Fruit Trees in Kent, she says we offer 2,400 different apples from the ancient Romeo Decchio to the old-fashioned Violet. And we hope we're creating a living legacy while helping communities in need. So if you want to find out more, go to growfruittrees.co.uk. What a great story. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The wind has come out of the beast, they are weak.